We'll begin with our blessing.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, asher bachar banu mikol hamim, v'na'atan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai, notein ha-Torah.
Amen. This week we are in Parsha Behar, which means on the mountain, referring to Mount Sinai. So it begins on page 697, is where we are. And the opening words are kind of interesting because all of a sudden now we are well past, quote, the time when we were at Mount Sinai, in what's happening with the Jewish people. But it opens up with Hashem spoke to Moshe on Mount Sinai and gave this commands, which we're going to talk about today, about the Shabbos, about Shemitah, about the sabbatical year, and about Yovel, about Jubilee. So the question is asked by many, why do we specifically need to know that this commandment was given at Mount Sinai? So if we think about it, that it could be that someone might think that Moshe, that God gave certain commandments to the Jewish people at Mount Sinai, and then over time, the people thought up other laws as well, and they kind of added this into the mix. So this is coming to tell us that these laws were given at Mount Sinai, and specifically when we see what's going to be involved with the laws specifically about Shemitah, about the sabbatical year, and about the Jubilee year, that this could only come from God, quite frankly, these laws, because nobody else would ever in their right mind, nobody else in their right mind could possibly make a law like this because of the what it is asking of people, what the implications are, and the ramifications, and how it would work, that this has to be of divine origin. No human being would ever make this kind of law, and in fact, we have never seen in the history of humanity anybody try to make a law like this, the ones that come across for us for the laws of Shemitah and the laws of Jubilee. So that's what we're going to look at today more in depth, is what these laws are. We're on page 696. And welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's take a look at this and see what happens and what this commandment is all about. We're going to basically take a mental spiritual trip here into a dimension of reality that we often don't have an opportunity to access. Because when we look at the structure of the sabbatical year and of Jubilee, we will see that we are going to have a window into looking at reality that is usually hidden from view and that we usually live in denial of. So let's see what this has to say to us. So why don't we begin chapter 25, page 697. And Lynn, would you like to start for us again, verse 1? And we're going to do verses 1 through 7. Why don't you take a few, and then Jan, if you would continue after that.
Hashem spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall observe a Sabbath rest from Hashem. For 6 years you may sow your field, and for 6 years you may prune your vineyard, and you may gather in its crop.
But the 7th year shall be a complete rest for the land, a Sabbath for Hashem. Your field you shall not sow, and your vineyard you shall not prune. The aftergrowth of your harvest you shall not reap, and the grapes you have set aside for yourself you shall not pick. It shall be a year of rest for the land. The Sabbath produce of the land shall be yours to eat, for you, for your slave, and for your maidservant, and for your laborer, and for your resident who dwell with you, and for your animal and for the beast that is in your land shall all its crop be to eat."
Okay, so what is happening here? Some people mistakenly look at the laws of sabbatical years like, oh, this is an agricultural law designed to protect the quality of the soil so that it should rest every 7 years and that will be more productive for the land. If we were going to do that, it would just say do that to rotate your crops and to have a year off. it would not necessarily require that everybody do it at the same time, because that means that there can be nothing planted anywhere in the boundaries of the land of Israel. Just for our information, this coming year is going to be a Shemitah year. When we get to Rosh Hashanah, it'll be a Shemitah year in the land of Israel. So that's very cool. It's challenging and it's cool. So let's talk about what it means and what we know about what happens during a Shemitah year. So during the Shemitah year, you cannot plant anything that is an annual. You can pick things to eat for food, like from trees and from the ground, anything that just grows like on its own, you can eat. And we also have to make it available to anybody else who wants to eat it. It doesn't belong to us. All of the produce, all of the fruit of the trees doesn't even belong to us for that year, which means that anybody can go onto anybody else's, quote, property and go and take whatever they want. And if a farmer has a fence around that's designed to keep animals out, they have to break it down in a place so the animals can get in, because the food is for everybody. Animals, that's what it says. And your animal and the beast that is in your land shall all its crop be to eat. It's like, it doesn't belong to us. So think about what that does to a person and how they view their property, my work, my effort, my land, my everything. It's like, it completely undoes that. It completely gets to the heart of, who does the land really belong to? It's like, if I say, does anybody here own property? Okay, I do. I own my home, the land. So the truth is who does the land really belong to? The world belongs to God. The entire universe belongs to God. We have an illusion that it belongs to us. We are tenants. We are lessees or leasers or whatever the proper term is. So the way the land works in the land of Israel, you cannot buy land in Israel. You have a lease on the land until the Jubilee, until the 50th year, when all land reverts to its original owners, and the original owners are whatever tribe it was designated for at the time of the conquest of the land of Israel by Joshua. So the land doesn't even belong to us. We have an illusion like, oh, I own this. So in Israel, if you buy farmland, what you're really buying is the produce, or whatever is going to be the productivity of the land, is what you are buying. You are not buying the actual real estate, because it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to God, and it has been designated for whatever tribes were designated to have that apportionment of the land. Patricia?
So when you buy land there, you really buy a lease.
That's right. It's a long-term lease.
It really legally says...
It's not yours.
Oh, wow.
It's not yours. So it's really fascinating, because we think like, oh, I own it, like, you know, security. Because what is it true? So we mentioned just the word security. Our sense of security often is founded on a sense of ownership, that I have power and control over something that gives me a sense of security. It's even why people like to collect things. Why do people collect things? They like to have things, because it gives them a sense of power and dominion. And I don't mean like in a Machiavellian way, like in a negative way necessarily. It's just human nature to want to own, possess, and have control over. It makes us feel secure. So this is saying, that's not where your security needs to come from. Your security comes from being a tenant on God's land. And that's a higher form of security. Debbie, did you have a...
Yeah, I have two questions. So this is only in Israel. So
only in the land of Israel.
Okay. And then when you said the Jubilee, that's not the 7th year Jubilee.
Right. The Jubilee we'll talk about next is the 50th year.
So every 50 years you tear up your lease?
So every 50 years. So we'll talk about what the criteria are for that. But basically, under certain conditions, everything goes back to its original owner. So you never have a long-term permanent claim to the land, because it doesn't belong to us. So the truth is that since Israel is really a microcosm for all of reality, since Israel represents the true reality, you say, oh, well, thank God, I live in Denver, so I can own my land. It's like, not really. So it's just that God lets us have that illusion for now. But the truth is that Denver, my little parcel at 760 Magnolia Street, no more belongs to me than if I had land in Israel. It's an illusion. It's an illusion. Susan.
I just want to make sure I understand that in Israel, this law applies to everyone. Or is it
some do it, some don't?
No, I think that when you buy land, that is the premise of land purchasing. It has nothing to do with that. It's the land of Israel. It's the land of
tribes.
So we do have tribes. They're just not there. Okay, so you're talking about, so we'll, let's save that for a moment, because that will apply for Jubilee, of when the Jubilee is counted and when how we observe it, because there are many criteria for it that are different than the sabbatical year. The sabbatical year is like Shabbos. It comes no matter what. Jubilee is different. Okay, Jubilee is going to be different. The sabbatical, the Shemitah year, that is true regardless. So last time there was a Shemitah year, which was 7 years ago, in Israel. I remember our son, when he went to get his etrog, for his lulav and etrog. So normally, when you buy a lulav and etrog anywhere in the world, when you pay the high amount of money that you were paying, you're paying for the etrog. The rest of the stuff is like worth 2 cents, okay? But the etrog is what costs, because of how much effort it takes to nurture the trees and take care of it and everything else. But during a Shemitah year, it cannot be sold. You cannot sell the etrog. The only thing you can pay for is for the transportation of it to wherever. So one of our son's friends went on for like the whole yeshiva and went to an etrog orchard and just gathered up, picked a lot of etrogs, brought them back to the yeshiva, and then posted a sign saying, "Come get your etrog." You know, it cost $2 for gas that I spent going to get it, or whatever. That was the cost of the etrog. There's no commerce, there's no economics on Shemitah produce. You think, this will completely undo the entire economic system of a country. How can you have this function? And yet God promises us, this is what will give you true security on the land. This is your security, because I, God, am your security. It's not the land, it's me. I can provide for you, and I will provide for you. Beth Ann.
When people start talking about how it doesn't matter, land doesn't matter, money doesn't matter, I'm always like, okay, so you give me your money and your land because it doesn't matter to you, but it might make a difference in my life. So how does one balance those realities?
This is the balance. Oh. It's the same way we balance our work week with Shabbos. So we have six days of the week. We are supposed to work and be involved in the economy and do what we do. And then on Shabbos, what do? I am not participating in anything like that. I am not having a hand in creating anything in this world. I let go completely. I let go. So you could say, well, if letting go is so good, so like, don't work at all. Just like, hang out for 7 days a week. It's like, we don't. We have 6 days we work, seventh day we let go. But our attitude towards our work on the 6 days changes when Shabbos is at the core. Because if I know I'm letting go and that what I do in a way really at some level doesn't matter, that I just need to put in my effort and really God is running everything anyway, I enter that work week with a sense of tranquility and calmness that is different than if I think I am in charge and I am in control and I must do everything. So the same thing is true on the Shemitah year, having the Shemitah year. For 6 years, you plant and you take the responsibility of an agricultural society and you do everything that you're supposed to do. But know that you are not really the cause of the produce that is coming. I'm giving it to you, God. I'm giving it to you those 6 years the same way I'm going to give it to you in the seventh year. Anyway, I'm just giving you this route of participation in the whole process, but you are not the determining cause. And in the seventh year, you'll see. You'll eat. You'll be just fine. In fact, it's not just the seventh year. It's going to be the eighth year also. Because if you don't plant in the seventh, then what are you eating in the eighth? And so the sixth year, you also have to eat. So the sixth year has to be a bumper crop of some sort that can last seventh and eighth year as well. So it's really a 3-year promise, which makes most people think about how challenging people find it to let go one day a week and let go just for Shabbos. Like, okay, I can hardly even do that, and now you're telling me to let go for a year? It's like, but I'm a farmer, and there's my land right out there, and I have to do it. It's like, no, you don't. This is a whole other level that we're supposed to get to, and it's the true reality. The rest of it is just kind of a, not a make-believe exactly, it's a construct for us to work in. Lynn, and then Susan, and then Valerie.
So how does it work in Israel when the Jews are observing it, and the other
Well, not even all the Jews observe it.
Right.
So there are Jews that do observe it, and I'll tell you a great story about it. And there's lots of stories. So it's hard. And it says that the there's a consequence for the Jewish people not observing it on the land, that the land will get its rest one way or another. In fact, one way we look at Jewish history of the exile of the Jews from the land is in consequence for them not observing it the way they were supposed to in some times and situations. Susan and then Valerie.
So it's not like the manna on before Shabbat where we got double portion? And
it is like that.
So you're allowed to like store up stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can store it up.
I thought with the manna you weren't supposed to.
Only on Friday do you store, because the portion you get on Friday is a double portion. So the portion you get in the sixth year is for the sixth and seventh year. You'll get more. Though, it's interesting. That's right. So it says, so you're also supposed to eat your fill, and it says don't hoard it. Okay, so there's all sorts of beautiful, don't hoard it, because hoarding is an expression of lack of trust. So it says you're supposed to eat your fill to satisfaction, and you will have plenty. It's not like, okay, everybody, you know, what is it, FHB, family hold back, you know, don't, okay, we got to have enough for the seventh year, so like, you know, or the seventh day. It's like, you will eat your fill and you will have plenty. And you will be satisfied. It's not, you won't starve. And that just makes human beings the most nervous ever. It says this is an expression of trust. And you will only feel the satisfaction if you have the trust. So there are two levels. There were those who had complete trust, and they didn't necessarily have what would on the surface look like a bumper crop, but they would have plenty, and they would be satisfied with what they had. And there were those who would be nervous and say, but what are we going to eat in the seventh year? And God says, for you, that's actually an expression of lack of trust, I will give you a bumper crop. And you say, well, how come a bumper crop? That's a consequence. But bumper, like an extra amount in quantity, in visible quantity, why would that be not necessarily the biggest blessing?
It will rot.
It won't rot. It'll be fine. But the amount of, how much work, and see, we don't even know this because we're not agricultural.
More work.
It's like, a bumper crop is good news on one hand after you have the crop in the silo. It's not, doesn't necessarily feel like a great blessing when you have to spend all the extra time harvesting. So the best response is, I have total trust that whatever you give me is going to be great, and I'll be fine, and I will be fine, and it won't on the surface look like more. The next level is asking the question, but what will we eat? That belies a lack of trust. It's like, for you, if you don't have so much trust, so for you, I'll give a bumper crop, which will be good news, bad news. You'll have the extra crop, and you'll have the extra work. So it's considered like a slightly lower level in that way. Valerie.
I didn't think to ask when I went to the wineries in Israel, but what do they do as far as harvesting the grapes for wine? Do they just not do it that year?
Not the ones that, well, grapes, you can pick them for yourself, but I'm not sure what they do for the, companies, but they're ones that observe the Shemitah, and it's interesting, very interesting. I'm sorry?
Do they have a Shemitah boy?
Yeah, really. What they have, though, is they have the wine. In fact, it's very interesting. We were at a simcha, and there was wine that was kosher wine made in Israel, but it had been produced during the Shemitah year because the date is on the wine. It's like, you know, the 2000 whatever. And so someone said, we actually can't drink this wine because it's during the Shemitah year. So we didn't. It's like, okay, take that back to Grapevine. Yeah, really. We got a chief case of it. So people have to be careful because not everybody does observe it. So, Jan.
Are there guidelines for what the farmers and their employees should be doing during that seventh year?
Beautiful. What are the Jewish people supposed to be doing during the Shemitah year?
Studying Torah.
It says that is what we're supposed to do. It says you are released, just like Shabbos. So what am I supposed to do? It's like, go study Torah. That's what you're supposed to do. What would you do if you had? That's what you do. A Jewish person is supposed to have, if I don't have responsibilities that I'm obligated to take care of, then I study Torah because that's what my preference would be to do all the time. The only reason I'm not studying Torah is because I have to work my field during those other 6 years. But if I had my druthers, I would be studying Torah and enjoying the time with my family and eating and being cared for, really taking us back to the Midbar experience of you'll have exactly what you need. Don't worry. Patricia.
So do they put little tags that say Shemitah? Right. So for perennials, like if you have a tree that produces apples, and you're leaving it open for anyone to come get, but you can't pick those
them. You can't sell them. You can eat them.
But you can eat them.
Yes, you can eat whatever to your heart's content.
Right.
You don't have to give them away. Anyone's free to come take. People come. Any stranger, anybody. This is like the most... Talk about all of the different economic revolutions that have happened in the world pale in comparison to Shemitah. Pale. Because it's not saying that a person who has property and who does work and has wealth is an evil person. We don't have like bad business, good labor. It's not that. It's like, yes, we need this, and the balance of all this is a reality check. So Shemitah is the reality check and the reset button on what this economic activity does. So everything, by virtue of being in the physical world, everything can lead towards a distortion. So when you have economic freedom, like we have in this country, theoretically, the most economic freedom than anybody, as someone said, it's the worst model out there, except that there's nothing better. Okay, so there's nothing better that provides more freedom. But clearly there are injustices that happen, but we don't say, okay, well then we'll just have, you know, anarchy and everybody can just do whatever they want and just have nothing. We don't have nothing. So if you're going to have a something, anything that's a something, some kind of a system, by definition is going to have built-in flaws that will lead to in some way, shape, or form, are going to lead to cruelty, they're going to lead to inequity, they're going to lead to all of the most inhumane conditions, even when the intention is to have it be the most humane. It says, even Nazism was a goal to improve the world, and look where that went. As was communism, as is social, all these isms have the goal. Nobody says, what I want to do is make the world a worse place. Nobody has that as their goal. Everyone's goal is improvement. Whether it works or not is going to really be based on, does it follow a Shemitah Yovel Jubilee model, or does it not? Jan.
So in modern day Israel, is there controversy regarding this, or do most of the agriculturists follow it?
Most of them do not follow it because most of them are not religious.
So they're So what did like the religious who live in the cities do?
They go to stores that have, first of all, you can buy things. This is so funny. Like the Arabs should love us. Okay, you can buy things that are grown on land that is not part of the boundaries of the land of Israel when Joshua's conquest of the land of Israel. So even though people think the Jews are trying to take over the world, we're not. We have very specific boundaries. Anything outside of that is not considered part of the Shemitah. You can buy from that. There's also things that are not in the ground. If it's hydroponic, that also changes it. So there's lots of different things. Jewish people are creative. There's lots of ways, and that's fine. So there's lots of different things. It's very complicated, and I don't even understand all of it.
So like the ship near Mea Shearim, what happens there?
So that will be a whole different thing of where that, what was paid for and how that got there and what exactly was paid for. You're not paying for the produce. You may be paying for the transportation and the display of it, but not for the produce itself.
So this year?
This coming year, starting in Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah will begin the year, the Shemitah year. So this is the sixth year. We're in the sixth year now of the cycle, the seventh year.
So next spring...
Rosh Hashanah.
I know, but I'm saying next spring, if I need to go to Israel again, the food will be coming from Jordan or somewhere else?
Or it'll be grown in the land of Israel on property, but it will be handled in a way that is different because it's a Shemitah year. And people will go to stores, and the kosher gets really, really, really complicated about where the food is from. And on top of that, any produce you have, let's say you have an apple from an apple tree, or let's just say a fig from a fig tree, and you got it, and it's Shemitah fruit, so it has kedusha to it. It has sanctity to it. That means that, let's say you only eat part of it, and you don't eat all of it. So you can't put it in the trash until it is completely gone bad. So people have special Shemitah holding. It's kind of like our composting things. They have it, they put it in a special container until it is rotten, and then it can go in a bag with some, excuse me, it can go in the bag then and go into the trash afterwards. But you can't just throw a good piece of fruit or a vegetable or something into the trash. So, because it has kedusha. Because, like, anything that grows during the Shemitah year is especially blessed because it was grown specially for you to enjoy. So if you're going to enjoy it, you kind of like when your mother would say there are starving children and whatever, like, they eat this food. It's like, eat it or don't throw it away while it is still good enough to eat. So either it cannot be thrown away, it has to be handled respectfully. Many people do that all the time with bread. They don't take bread and throw it, like crusts or ends of bread. They don't just throw it in the trash. They will wrap it in a, like a napkin or something special, and then put it in the trash. You say, well, it's still in the trash. But still having in mind a mindfulness about the dignity and the special status of bread. And that's all the time that people do that. So there's all of this sensitivity about what's grown in the land of Israel and the gift and God's blessing and bounty for us. Okay, so that's the Shemitah year, Debbie.
Can they still water and fertilize the orchard?
You can, so it's a difference about trees. There are certain things that you can do to maintain trees, and there's certain things you can't do. I don't know the details, but there's a whole set of things. The Rambam, Maimonides, has it all listed out, so this is a good time to introduce the story I was going to tell you. So I heard this from Rabbi Aryeh Carmel, and is a story about in the 1950s in the land of Israel, which 1950 should tell you, toward the beginning of when it was a state, and trying to settle the land and bring produce and bring, you know, food and the whole agricultural process. So the government, the Ministry of Agriculture, had a whole program where they're going to give to farmers, to orchard, whatever, are those called farmers? If you have an orchard, are you a farmer? I don't know. You can see how agricultural I am, agrarian I am. They would give an orchard's worth of trees to whoever, but you had to have, there are certain stipulations on how you had to take care of it in order to be able to have it for free. And it was 500,000 trees for the orchards. So there was a, like a kibbutz or a moshav, a place in Israel that was religious, and they wanted to have the trees, but they went over the list of what was required, and this was being introduced during a Shemitah year, or like the right before a Shemitah year and was going to start. And the requirements were for like the first year of the orchard, which was going to overlap with Shemitah. So the rabbi of this community that was going to have the orchard went over the list compared to what the Rambam said could be done, and went to the Ministry of Agriculture and said, we want the trees, but we can only do, you know, 1, 3, 5, 7, and 15 of these lists. We can't do these others because of the Shemitah year. How he talked them into giving them the trees, he did. But then everybody was like, other people were all upset, like, it's not fair, you're having these trees, and you're going to ruin them, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, we follow what the Torah said. This is the land of Israel, we're following what the Torah said. So, I don't know what the exact numbers were, that year's crop, that next year's crop, with them not doing whatever it was, the not fertilizing, the not whatever that they couldn't do, that was supposed to guarantee that the trees prosper, they had, and there were maybe 60 other places where they did this. This religious community that had this orchard, theirs had the biggest crop of fruit out of all of them. People said, how did you do that? I said, we follow what the Rambam says. You think you know better based on your agricultural whatever. The Rambam knows what happens, how the land of Israel works. This is what we do. And that's what they do. There's all sorts of stories. Every Shemitah year, every year, there's always stories about who has what and how the crops are working and the people who are the naysayers and how it works. You would think people would kind of get the message, but it just goes so against our sense of control and being in charge that we just have a hard time letting go. So that's the Shemitah year. Gabi.
Shemitah year is questions. If we have a tree here in the land of Israel, do we have to wait 5 years to be?
You do, yes.
On the fifth year, I think.
I think it's the fifth. You do have to wait a certain amount of time, and I'm not sure, because there's 1 year that it would be different because we don't have the temple and you can't take Bikurim to the temple. That we would have to explore that to find out what's in effect.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Didn't you say when you went to Israel, Shemitah year, it was a stick year on the food that would say it was salt that had a stick year?
It's all, bless you. Yeah, things are labeled. I can't really describe it to you. It's very complicated the way it all works. But yeah, that's what, as I was saying, there are stores that are the, you know, the religious grocery stores that sell things, and everything is marked, and it tells you where it's from and what its status is and what you need to do with it. Never mind how many calories or fat grams. It's like, that's the easy stuff. It's like,
it doesn't matter whether it was an Arab or a non-Jewish farmer.
It doesn't matter who's doing the work. It matters the land, where the land is. It's a geographical question.
Non-Jew still, you cannot work
in it. No. Yeah, it's not like a, like we said, like a Shemitah Goy. That has nothing to do with who's doing the work on the land. So, yeah, it doesn't work that way. So this whole idea, so you see what this does to people and what the economics is of this, to make everything open to everyone, where the boundaries are kind of loosened up, and there is a, and it's not so much generosity. I'm not being generous. I'm being realistic. I don't have an option. I can say, oh, yes, I am inviting you to come to my orchard and take what you want. I have no option. What I'm supposed to say is, I know this land doesn't really belong to me. God is the source of everything I have, and I'm letting go the same way I do every Shabbos. So this is what this is telling me, that this is a reality check. It's not generosity. It's not any of those things. However, it can impact our generosity, because one reason why someone may not be generous is because we have such a tight hold on everything that we think we own. So if I don't really think I own it, then I can be much more open with it, because it's not my source of security. It's not my source of identity. It's not my source of power. So why not share it? So people who lack generosity are usually lacking in those elements. And so this does lead to generosity, because it gives us a truer sense. It's like how people are usually more generous in giving away other people's money, right? It's like, it's not my money. Yeah, help yourself. So when I see that my money is also not my money, so help yourself. Whatever you want, you may have it. So it is a training ground for us as well in generosity, but it's not through the act of generosity. It is a byproduct of it. And the other byproduct is a sense of tranquility, because then I don't have to make myself so crazy all the time over what's mine and what I have. What's going to really do this in spades is the Jubilee year. So let's go on to read about that and talk about how that is different, because that is a whole other level. It is, that is its main thing. So just as we saw that the 40 years in the Midbar, in the desert, was primarily and exclusively a training ground and trust in God. That's why when we have Shabbos, we are obligated at each of our Shabbos meals to have 2 loaves of bread. That is, we are eating the trust that we are trying to take in. So somebody who has a half a loaf of bread, that's not trust. It's like, that means you ate half and you saved half. That is the opposite of trust. So Shabbos is about trusting God. You gave me enough. And the Midbar was about trust. And the manna was about trust. And that was the whole thing. The whole 40 years in the Midbar was only because of the sin of the spies, that the Jewish people did not trust that God was giving them the land. That was the whole problem. So it's like, okay, we're going to have an intensive training, 38 more years to learn trust, because you cannot live in this land of Israel. It wasn't punishment. It was like if somebody does an evaluation of a student and says, okay, this is where you are. You need some remedial help in order for you to be successful. I don't do you any favors by saying, okay, go up into the next grade and just flounder. You say, no, let's hold you back, give you what you need, and then you can go in and be successful. So Jewish people were held back for remedial trust training, so that they could go into the land of Israel and be successful, because you cannot live in the land of Israel to this day without a tremendous trust in God. That's what it takes. All right, so let's read now about the Jubilee year. we'll pick it up on verse 8. So, Patricia, would you like to continue?
You shall count for yourself 7 cycles of sabbatical years, 7 years, 7 times. The years of the 7 cycles of sabbatical years shall be for you 49 years. You shall sound a broken blast on the shofar in the 7th month, on the 10th of the month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall sound the shofar throughout your land.
Okay, yes, keep going.
You shall sanctify the 50th year and proclaim freedom throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be the Jubilee year for you, and you shall return each man to his ancestral heritage, and you shall return each man to his family. It shall be a Jubilee year for you this 50th year. You shall not sow, you shall not harvest its undergrowth, and you shall not pick what was set aside of it for yourselves. For in a Jubilee year, it shall be holy to you. From the field you may eat its crop. In this Jubilee year, you shall return each man to his ancestral heritage.
Okay. First of all, what numbers are we working with here? That are always, okay, the 7 times 7, 49, plus, and then we'll hit the next year, the 50th year, which will be Jubilee. So this, of course, should remind us of the pattern that we're in right now, of counting of the Omer, of 7 times 7 weeks, and then the 50th day will be Shavuot, of standing at Har Sinai to receive the Torah. So there is a similarity between Jubilee, the Yovel, and Shavuot as well. But mostly what we're going to talk about is this idea that 7 times 7, 49, and then the 50th always takes us up to the dimension of 8. Okay, that's really the beginning of the 8th round, just like the day of Shavuot is really the beginning of the 8th week, that we don't count, we just enter into. So they're going to count for yourself 7 cycles of sabbatical years, but it doesn't say, and you will count the 50th year. It means you will announce the 50th year, and how is it going to be announced?
Shofar blast.
And when is it going to be announced? Yom Kippur. It's like, what is that about? Why is the Jubilee year tied to Yom Kippur? Okay, so it has to do with the essence of what Yovel is all about. So first of all, hopefully everybody recognized the words that are engraved on our Liberty Bell of this country, where it says, proclaim freedom throughout the land to all the inhabitants thereof. That comes from this week's Parsha. So that is what's on the Liberty Bell. So it was like the goal of the United States to be a place where there was liberty for everybody. That is its goal. Verse 10 on page 698. Dvar ba'aretz lechol yoshvecha yovel hi. Okay, so that's what's on the Liberty Bell in English, not in Hebrew. But that's our contribution here, and it's a beautiful contribution. It's a beautiful goal to have, that this country be a place of liberty. But the fact that it needs to be sanctified in the 50th year, so it's not counted, it's not part of the count, it is a consecration. You shall sanctify the 50th year and proclaim freedom throughout the land for all its inhabitants. It shall be the Jubilee year for you. Each of you shall return to the ancestral heritage. So what's added to Jubilee that was not the same as Shemitah, the same as sabbatical? Well, first of all, it's another sabbatical year. So talk about making people really, really nervous. You just had your 7th year, like in year 49, that was the Shemitah year, and now I'm going to have another one?
Two in a row?
That's like making me really nervous. Okay, so this, hopefully by this time, people are in a cycle. Excuse me. However, you probably haven't heard of a Jubilee year announced in a really long time, and that's because it hasn't been announced. Okay, unlike the Shemitah year, which happens like Shabbos regardless, the Jubilee year has to be sanctified and proclaimed by the Sanhedrin. That needs to be announced by the court, and that can only take place. That can only take place when all of the tribes are in the land of Israel and everybody is in their places where they're supposed to be, and the land of Israel is under its leadership, under a Torah authority. Until we have that, the Jubilee, we don't count it, and we don't announce it. So none of these things now can be practiced. But it's not because we are done with them and we took them off the books. It's that we don't yet meet the criteria for it. I believe that you do have to have the temple, but I'm not positive. I know that all 12 tribes have to be back. It's like everyone has to come home. So what's really interesting and beautiful is the word Yovel itself alludes to the idea of coming home. So the root of that is Yud Bet Lamed, and it means to bring home, to come home. Something that brings, carries something home is, has that same root. A stream or a tributary is called a yuval, which means to, it takes something from one place to the next. It brings home. So that's the essence of yuval and yovel, is to bring home. So who's coming home? So if you were not such a good business person and you ended up selling your inheritance, so it can only be away from your family for a maximum of 50 years. We're going to assume all 12 tribes are now in the land of Israel. And then it has to go back to you.
Wow.
And so if you have to sell it, again, you're not selling the land. You are selling the productivity of what can happen on that land. Whatever somebody wants to build on it or produce on it, that's what you're selling. You're not selling the land itself. The land will revert back to you after in the Jubilee year.
And you kick out the
We don't kick them out.
They have to
leave. And they know that, because when they sign it, it is until the Jubilee year. So it is a, and so the price will be adjusted. So let's say somebody sells their land in year 46 because they have debts to pay off. They're not going to get as much money for it as if they sell it in year 2, because the person knows that they can only have it for a certain amount of time. So it is a lease ownership as opposed to a free and clear. It is not free and clear, it is a lease. Okay, it's a, what's called leasehold as opposed to freehold.
So they're still counting the years even though the tribes are not
all in Israel? I don't even know if people are, I don't even know where we are. I don't know if it's being counted or when the tribes come back that then they start the count. I'm not sure. But the lease is, I'll say, and when there is a Jubilee year, then this would be, this would end. So no, people aren't now. So I guess people are hedging their bets. Like, it's not looking like they're coming back real soon. I think we'll go for the, you know, realistically. But then someone says, like, don't be so sure about that. Things could change in a moment. And when they do, they will. So the land would go back. Also, if a Jewish person sold themselves into servitude in order to make money, then they are also released. Even the person who at the Shemitah year wanted to stay with their master, even though that person should have been done with their service and has their ear bored, in the Jubilee year, you have no choice. You are done being an indentured servant. You go home again. Even if you don't want to, you go home again, because the Jewish people are servants of God. That's who our service is to, not servants of other people. Any other kind of servitude has to be short term. So we see then what happens is this is an economic equality comes back, social equality comes back, and everything is rebooted and recalibrated back to let's start over again. And this is the process that allows the Jewish people to function in an economic society that can both make progress and be truly humane at the same time. And the critical piece is, it's very interesting. So those two things have to happen. Returning the land to ancestral heritage, return of all indentured servants back to their homes. And the third piece, which you would think is just kind of a, you know, like a bless you, that is a nice to have, is that the shofar has to be sounded. If you don't sound the shofar, it doesn't kick in. You have to have all three pieces. It's like, why do you have to have the shofar in there? It says, because the shofar is the spiritual part. That tells you that we're not doing this because we are political free thinkers. It's not because we are open-minded, whatever. It is because we recognize that everything is coming from God. If it does not have a God focus, it will always deteriorate. That's how we can look at the other economic revolutions that have gone on in the world, down to our own capitalistic system that we have here, which I said is very good, but it certainly brings in people who, for whatever reason, don't function well in this system. Excuse me. So we know there are some people, they're not great business people, or they are intellectually not at a level where they contribute real well, emotionally real well, and they fall through the cracks. And they're the ones who then become the challenge to our society. This system guarantees that all people are then periodically put in the right position. Oh, thank you. Thank you. This again changes people's, has the potential to change people's thinking. The other thing that happens, it says when the shofar was blown throughout the land, everybody knew that everybody was doing it. It wasn't just, well, Farmer Jones is giving back his land, but Farmer Smith is keeping his. So nobody wants to be, you know, the person who's the odd man out in any kind of an economic thing. But if everybody is doing it, then it gives everybody the ability to see it as normal, and this is what we're doing. So even though we just think that only kids are subject to peer pressure and to peer impact, it's like, not true. Mm-hmm. Everybody is, and the shofar blast throughout the land, in every community, everywhere, was like, this is what we're doing now, everybody, so that it brings people along. And it addresses the human nature, which is to be resistant to this whole idea. Patricia.
So this can't happen until the 12 tribes are reestablished. So,
right.
And because there's 10 lost tribes, this probably nobody thinks will happen until the Messianic era.
It is possible that until Mashiach comes, because when we talk about, when we daven each day, we talk about the ingathering of the exiles.
Right.
It's like, those people are there. They didn't disappear off the face of the earth, so they're there somewhere.
So somehow they'll know.
They'll know. Just, I think, you know, I use it as a small metaphor, but like when the children who were taken, very happily taken, or we were gratefully taken by Catholic churches and convents to hide children during the Holocaust. But then after the Holocaust, when the rabbi came to go collect Jewish children and they had baptized them and made them Christian, they said, there are no Jewish children here. And I was like, I don't believe it. And he went in and he started saying the Shema. And the kids who cried or who looked up, it's like, those are the Jewish kids. So there'll be some sort of it's like, I'll take this one, and that one. Those are Jewish kids. And then they didn't deny it, thank God, after that. There will be some sort of a homing pigeon call, and maybe that's the ultimate Yuval, the ultimate coming home that will happen is the Jewish people will come home. So they'll come home, and they'll come home. And then we'll know who everybody is, and it'll be clear. Since the Mashiach will be able to kind of smell everyone out, we'll know who is who and what's what and what needs to happen. So that's kind of like that's the end game. It could happen before then. Who knows? We have no idea. But that's the end game, is this coming home. And it makes sense that it would occur with Yom Kippur. You could think, well, why is it Rosh Hashanah? It's a new year or something like that. Why is it Yom Kippur? Because Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement, is the day of our ultimate closeness with God, where we come home. That's what teshuva is to return to our souls, our true selves. So what could be more of a return than Yom Kippur? That's our true self. So on Yom Kippur is when this Yovel gets started, this Jubilee year. And it is a tremendous accomplishment for the Jewish people to be able to reach this level. So imagine how the world, even if the rest of the world doesn't do this, so imagine a messianic time. So I said, we're going to go on a spiritual journey. Imagine in the time when there is instant information and everybody knows everything. Imagine the reporters from CNN converging on the land of Israel during a Shemitah year when all the Jewish people are observing it, because that will happen also. And they go like, we're here, you know, in Tel Aviv in a farm where they have not watered or done anything for the past, you know, 9 months, and yet we see that there is a crop and everybody's eating, and we see animals roaming around, and we don't know how to explain what's happening. It seems to be some bizarre occurrence. So imagine like what it conveys to the world, and then people will speak up and they'll say, God is taking care of us. It's not like, oh, we were very good farmers in the sixth year, let us tell you our new drip technology. It's like, it's not going to be about that. It'll be an expression in actual physical terms that everyone can relate to, for people to see what a society looks like that operates under God's protection and under God's care, where we're not the passive. It's not at all a passive thing. Oh, like, well, we're just, it's so easy to be religious. You just do what, you don't have to make any decisions. It's not true. To fulfill these laws requires the most extreme and developed expression of emuna, of faith and trust that a person can have, because it means reorienting oneself to a whole new understanding of how things truly work. That's not the way the rest of the world appears to work. It's not how we usually seem to work. So it'll be an amazing thing. It says that will be the proclamation that will go out to all the world, and that's what will be truly transformative. Because other people will be able to do it if they want, but the Jewish people will be this beacon of light, of the social equality, the economic equality, at the same time, not through backwardsness, not through the communists where they don't let you leave because you'll be an enemy, a traitor to the state. It'll be open, open, and successful at the same time. And to be able to have economic progress and social and economic equality, that model does not yet exist and that we see in our world. The Shemitah year and the Jubilee are what bring us the closest, and that's what will help us achieve that. Cindy.
When after 1948, was that what they considered year one, or was somebody like, kind of tracking it?
No, it was tracked before then, because it's not based, the Shemitah year is not based on the statehood of the land of Israel. That's been tracked all the way through. So that. I'm sorry?
The Torah doesn't know when the Jubilee was. 48 was when the state was born.
Right, no, so that started as soon as the people went into the land of Israel. And those years have been kept track of this whole time. So there wasn't a time when it wasn't kept track of. So that's really an interesting. I just find this so fascinating. Yes?
Is it known how many Jubilee years have been observed?
It probably is known, but I'm not the one who knows it. It probably is known. But that had to be under, as we said, under very special circumstances. It had to be when all the tribes were in the land of Israel. It had to be when there was the Sanhedrin. There had to be a court. There had to be a whole thing. There had to be much more of a structure. And I don't know, maybe there even had to be a structure for the enforcement of it. I'm not even sure of how that worked. Because I'm sure there were always people who maybe didn't want to go along with the program. Because the Jewish people are not angelic, so like we are people. So I don't even know what all went around with it. I'm sorry? There may be. I didn't investigate that. You look it up. You could look that up. So hopefully our goal is to reap the lessons of this, because we could say, oh, well, good, we don't have to do this because it's not in effect now. But the truth is that we read about this because this, again, is a reality check about how the world is supposed to work, how we want it to work, and what our role is in it. So we can still cultivate a Yovel mentality, a Shemitah mentality, where we are connected to our physical property, to our physical efforts, but we are not so tightly attached to them that it's like pulling, like ungripping our lock on our physicality and on our material wealth. That if we could have the attitude to use what we have in a way that expresses the idea of what the Jewish people would have come to in practicing this, but without going through the actual process, that would be a tremendous spiritual accomplishment. And that's what the Shemitah year is for, even now, even outside the land of Israel. It's like, let it go. Open up. Share. This doesn't really belong to you. So we know that in Pirkei Avot, there's a group of sayings that says, there are some people that says, what's yours is yours, and what's mine is mine. What's yours is mine, and what's mine is yours. And let's see, no, there's three. Sorry. And what's yours is mine, and what's mine is mine. Oh, and there's four. And what's yours is yours, and what's mine is yours. It says, what is the highest level? So you'd think we are used to saying, if I say what's yours is yours, and what's mine is mine, that's good. That's how most societies function. That's considered a good thing. That's considered the wickedness of Sodom. It says, that's selfishness. I have my things, you have your things, gegazint, as they say. Good health, I'll keep what's mine, you keep what's yours. So most, laws about properties and boundaries and everybody have what belongs to them. But that doesn't involve an attitude of sharing. A person who says, what's yours is mine, and what's mine is mine, is obviously a cruel, degenerate person because they have no respect for anybody. I have what I have, and I also take what belongs to you. A person becomes twisted, even though we think it's an expression of love. What's mine is yours, and what's yours is mine. It's like, who gave me the right to say that what's yours is mine? That's not anything. It's like, oh, what's yours is mine, and what's mine is yours, so I'm coming to your house because what's yours is mine, and so I'll take it. So that leads also to a distortion. What is considered ideal is when I say, what's yours is yours, and I respect your rights to what you have, and what's mine is yours. And that's about me opening up and recognizing that anything I have, and I'm the only person I have control over, I want you to have access to it because I know that it all belongs to God anyway, and so I'm just a vehicle, and if I have something that you can use, I'm happy to share it. But I'm not infringing my role, my perspective on you, and I will do everything to protect your rights to what you have. It says, that's a tzaddik. That is a person who is completely righteous. So that mentality comes from understanding Shemitah, from understanding Yovel, and understanding that that is the way the world truly works. So God willing, even though we are not in the time that we'll be entering a Shemitah year, but that we don't have the privilege of having the Jubilee year yet, that when we think about our own Liberty Bell, that we have a very vivid reminder of what our ultimate goal is, and that we have the land to return to its ancestral heritage, people return to that, that people return to their homes, that they are no longer indentured servants, but without the shofar blast that says that this all has a spiritual source. That's what guarantees that it will work and not degenerate into an inhumane effort to try to be humane. So that is ultimately our goal. So God willing, we will have the privilege of witnessing it, and maybe all those people who signed those leases will see that pretty soon we'll have a Jubilee year. So God willing, we will. Have a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos, and enjoy this beautiful mitzvah that was given at Mount Sinai.
Grocery stores mix the ones with it.